journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, June 28th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, a new book by acclaimed author Chris Hedges in collaboration with award-winning graphic artist Joe Sacco explores the sacrifice zones of American capitalism and how ordinary Americans are fighting back.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A new book by acclaimed author Chris Hedges in collaboration with award-winning graphic artist Joe Sacco explores America's poorest, most decimated towns in an effort to foresee our collective future if corporate greed continues to run amok. Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt is the first book the two authors have published together based on interviews they conducted during their travels. Starting with Pine Ridge, South Dakota, Hedges and Sacco explore the devastation wreaked historically and currently on the U.S.'s Native American population, a story that sets the tone for how resources and communities have been exploited ever since. Turning to Camden, New Jersey, Hedges and Sacco expose the end stage of what happens to towns that are highly industrialized and then abandoned when they are no longer able to churn profits. Welch, West Virginia is the third site featured in the book, a living example of environmental destruction from coal mining industries that affects the land and human health alike. And immigrant labor's experience with slavery in Immokalee, Florida is the focus of the fourth chapter in Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Liberty Square, New York, the birthplace of the Occupy Wall Street movement, ends the book on a hopeful note of how Americans are finally drawing connections between their own lives and the corporate greed of Wall Street elites and rising up. Chris Hedges will be speaking tonight at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church at 7 p.m., 3300 Wilshire Boulevard is the address. It's an event that's co-sponsored by TruthDig.com, where he's a columnist. The event is organized by KPFK, and tickets are $15 each. If you've already purchased tickets, your names will be at will call. And if you haven't, tickets will be available at the door. Chris Hedges now joins me in studio. He's a frequent guest on Uprising. Welcome back to the show, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, looking through your book, you profile four cities, not counting what's going on and what had been going on in New York City with the Occupy Wall Street movement. These four cities and towns, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, Welch, Virginia, Camden, New Jersey, Immokalee, Florida. How did you and Joe choose these cities? Why did you choose them to profile in your book?
Well, we went to the poorest places in the country. Camden is per capita the poorest city in the United States. Pine Ridge is always first or second in terms of one of the poorest counties in the United States. The coal fields of southern West Virginia are economically and environmentally destroyed. And then, of course, the plight of undocumented workers in the nation's produce fields. These are all sacrifice zones. They're areas that were made to kneel before the marketplace. There are areas where communities and individuals had absolutely no protection from the predatory nature of corporate capitalism. And we wanted to show what happens when the dictates of the marketplace determine how human societies are formed. Because now that all impediments are lifted against corporate power, these sacrifice zones are just going to leach outwards. That what they did to them, in biblical terms, our neighbor, African Americans in our internal colonies in the inner city, of course, Native Americans, where it all began, coal miners, produce pickers, they're going to do to us. I think that part of the power of the book, which has 50 illustrations and comic panels by Joe Sacco, is and part of the goal of the book, is to make these people visible because the wider society has rendered them invisible. And I think that, you know, it is able to raise the book and give it a kind of punch that it wouldn't have without that artwork.
So the visuals in the book, which is different from your other books, I mean, this is a first-time collaboration with Joe Sacco, who's, you know, known in his own right for his work such as Footnotes and on Gaza. The visuals give it a different dimension. Some of the stories, which are the personal stories in the book of people that you interview, are told entirely in comic book format. Why is that?
I think the most powerful personal narratives we both understood should be turned over to Joe, because he can, through comic panels, give it a kind of filmic quality. He can go back. I mean, for instance, we interviewed a miner, Rudy, who since passed away, who began working in the coal mines in southern West Virginia as a teenager after his own father was killed in a mine accident in the 1930s. This was before the mines were even mechanized. And, of course, before they were unionized. And so it showed, you know, what mine conditions were like, what happened when the unions came. The only time he ever leaves southern West Virginia is when he's drafted in World War II and is wounded in the Battle of the Bulge. You not only hear the dialogue from the interview, but you actually see, you know, all of those sort of passages throughout his life. And you know, it was sort of, as a writer, I was giving up often what was most precious because I understood that Joe could do things with those narratives that I couldn't do in simple prose.
So, I mean, and it's amazing because his artwork, of course, goes beyond simple photography. It's not just photographs. As you said, he's brought to life the memories of these people.
Yes. And, you know, he's incredibly meticulous. For instance, when he was drawing Rudy as a young man in the mines, he went back and found photographs of all of the old mine equipment. I mean, he's so conscientious about accuracy. Yeah, I think that's right. I think that it is the capacity to bring it to life. And, you know, you can do things through illustrations that you can't do through photography. I remember when we were, and we've worked before, but never on a book. We've worked on magazine pieces together, but in a refugee camp, for instance, in Gaza, it's often in the rain, you know, very muddy. The mud gets 2, 3, 4 inches deep. And you can remind a reader of that, of those conditions through prose. But when you draw it out, it's in every single panel. And I think it gives it a kind of force that is unique to graphic art.
The first chapter of your book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, is placed in Pine Ridge. And I think it's appropriate starting there because you're able to trace the history of American colonization and link it to the corporate devastation that we see in Pine Ridge today. What struck me was how rampant alcoholism and sexual abuse is in this area. How do you explain what is happening in Pine Ridge? How do you draw the links between the way in which this part of the country has just been abandoned and how people, in a way, mutilate themselves and others?
Well, Pine Ridge is important, as you pointed out, because it is where the whole demented project began. Railroad companies, gold speculators, timber speculators came in and decimated physically the indigenous population to steal their land, breaking treaty after treaty after treaty, and forcing the remnants of native populations into, in essence, detention camps, which later became Indian reservations. And it wasn't just about the theft of land and the theft of resources and genocide. It was about destroying a competing ethic, another way of relating to each other and relating to the natural world. In indigenous cultures, people who hoard and amass goods for themselves are despised. There is, of course, a communal quality. Everything is shared. The natural world has an element of the sacred. It isn't simply commodified to exploit until exhaustion or collapse, which is why Native Americans were horrified when white colonists came in and slaughtered the buffalo herds, often just leaving the carcasses to rot, or in some cases just cutting out the tongues of the buffaloes, which were a delicacy that were shipped back east. You know, everything was destroyed. Land was suddenly sold. This was just an anathema to Native culture. You didn't buy and sell land. And, you know, the United States is unique in a sense that it colonized itself. European powers went to India or Africa to colonize. Here we began on our own territory, and then it became the template once we finished westward expansion. And, of course, this notion of manifest destiny, that we have a sacred right mandated by God to rule as the white race. We carried this overseas to the Philippines, to Cuba, to Central America, to Vietnam, and now, of course, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the inability to recognize the sacred, to recognize that anything, either the natural world or human beings, have an intrinsic value beyond a monetary value, means that when you finish, as they have, cannibalizing these parts of the country, and southern West Virginia, we flew over it, it's just a wasteland, hundreds of thousands of acres of poisoned landscape, the whole tops of the mountains blown off, the streams poisoned, the air poisoned. It's never coming back. There's no sense of, you know, the custodial role, the need to maintain a world for future generations. And resources were at one point on the planet abundant enough that when a particular civilization collapsed, you could move on and have another one. This time, of course, carrying this ethic as far as we've carried it and without a radical change in our relationship to each other and to the natural world, you know, this time when we go down, the whole planet's going to go down with us. It's just going to be Easter Island writ large. And those people within these sacrifice zones who are trapped there and can't get out, and remember the statistics are just horrifying. The average life expectancy for a male on Pine Ridge is 48. That's the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. At any one time, 60% of the people in Pine Ridge have neither electricity or water. Of course, massive unemployment, an estimated 80% alcoholism rate. We found that in these sacrifice zones, in these pockets of despair, in these areas where the marketplace has been able to destroy all capacity for dignity and autonomy and self-worth, people go one of two ways. They either go in, they hang on by their fingertips through religious belief, not necessarily Christian. In Pine Ridge, of course, it's the traditional sweat lodges and the Sundance. We went to a Sundance, deeply moving, 4 days of fasting and watching young men with prison tattoos, you know, struggle to sort of hold their lives together. Or you succumb to the despair of narcotics or substances like Southern West Virginia, it's Oxycontin. They call it hillbilly heroin. I mean, you would go in some of these old coal camps in Southern West Virginia, and those who would remain behind, completely devastated. Joe and I felt like we were back in Bosnia at the end of the war, all the abandoned houses all burned to the ground, just sort of spindly chimneys sticking up out of the charred remains. And those who would remain behind, they're like zombies. They've sort of ingested so much of these opiates. You know, their speech is slurred and slow. They move slowly. I mean, one young man we interviewed died of an overdose a few weeks after we interviewed him. And I think that self-medication is, you know, when you are spend as much time as we did in these environments, completely understandable, because it is a way to blunt the hell that corporations have created for the underclass and the hell that they are creating for expanding segments of the population.
I'm speaking with Chris Hedges, and if you're just tuning in, he's going to be speaking tonight in Los Angeles at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church about his new book with Joe Sacco, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, and the event can be found online at kpfk.org. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. The church is located at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. Limited numbers of his book are going to be available for sale. There will also be a book signing after. Now, Chris, you write also with Joe about Camden, New Jersey. Well, I should say you're the principal author. You write the prose part of it, and Joe just does these beautiful illustrations and comic panels, bringing to life what the two of you saw and experienced and the people that you met with. Camden is not just one of the poorest, or maybe the poorest, town in the U.S., but it's also one of the most dangerous. And here again, what we were just talking about, the sort of self-destruction that people succumb to. You say violence begets violence. It is as old as the Bible. And in Camden, the violence is in the form of gangs in particular, and just amazing these sorts of, and you also talk about the political violence in Camden. What is Camden's story? It started out in history as being an amazing center of industry.
Well, it was one of the industrial hubs, partly because it was located on the Delaware River right across from Philadelphia. And at its height, the shipyards in Camden alone employed 36,000 people. RCA Victor was there. The great tenors, Caruso, used to come and record in Camden. Campbell Soup was there. And then everything went. In other cities, at least something's left. In Camden, nothing is left. There are no jobs unless you work in one of the roughly 100 open-air drug markets. It produces nothing. It makes nothing. Whole sections of the city are abandoned. You can literally drive down streets where every single house has been abandoned, sometimes trees growing out of gas stations. And in that sense, it's sort of a perfect example of post-industrial America. The ability of corporations to move manufacturing centers overseas, and the fact that the jobs that were lost have never been replaced and indeed never will be replaced. The New York Times ran a story a few days ago where they looked at members of the middle class who had lost jobs in 2008 and then managed to get new jobs, and in almost all cases, wages were 50%. Half of what they had been pre-2008, and often, of course, without any kind of benefits or job protection. That's the world that we're rapidly creating, a world that replicates the sort of power structure that George Orwell laid out in 1984, where you have the inner party, that's the Wall Street financiers, and 3 or 4%. You have the outer party, 12% roughly, corporate managers, and then the rest of us are proles. And I didn't want to write a book that was a polemic. When you read sort of story after story, and all of this, of course, is written off, from the bottom, you just can't argue with the destructive force of unfettered and unregulated capitalism. Camden, of course, is one of our internal colonies. Everybody, it seems, that we interviewed got cycled through the prison system. And I think it's also an important case study because it shows how, for the elite, poverty is a business. You have the most powerful figure in Camden, George Norcross III, who is white, who does not hold elective office, and who doesn't even live in Camden. But he's the Democratic political boss in southern New Jersey, and all sort of reconstruction monies, any kind of aid to Camden gets funneled through his hands. And it never reaches, of course, the residents of Camden. It doesn't do anything to ameliorate the massive unemployment or the horrid living conditions. I mean, the sewer system in Camden is decrepit and often dysfunctional. It all goes to his pet projects, Cooper Hospital, and it's about patronage. He hires those firms that support his political base. One of the people we interviewed, a former member of the city Council, you know, called Norcross and those like him the pimps of poverty. And I think that, you know, that example is just sort of writ large across the country, that, you know, the sort of criminal class in this country doesn't use the old sort of mafia tactics of, you know, kneecapping people or beating them up. They just use massive sums of money. Norcross is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. To essentially destroy anybody who steps in front of their manipulation of the system to gain personal empowerment and personal wealth. And what's happened, of course, is that Norcross, although he's a Democrat, is now closely allied with Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, a Republican. And I think that is a kind of window into the political breakdown. Not only on a local level, but on a national level, that we become completely hostage to these incredibly wealthy corporate overlords, this oligarchic class, and that all of the mechanisms by which we as citizens could defend ourselves, whether that's labor unions, whether that's regulatory agencies, whether that's a functioning press. I mean, let's, you know, that once the sort of lights are flipped out, in terms of journalism, there's absolutely no control over these people at all. That we as a nation essentially have undergone this coup d'état, this corporate coup d'état in slow motion, and if we don't respond quickly, and if we don't begin to build mass movements, then. You know, the only word corporations know is more. We are going to be pushed and pushed and pushed. And we've just seen it in the last few weeks where you have a refusal to extend unemployment benefits for hundreds of thousands of American citizens, an assault against the food stamp program, an assault against public sector worker unions by the Supreme Court. There is no way to stop it within the formal mechanisms of power, and I think that they, you know, by the time you read through these stories within these sacrifice zones, you understand how absolute corporate control has become.
Well, this man George Norcross III, who you just talked about, he represents this intersection of and this overlapping, I should say, of corporate power and being able to use the official electoral process of governance. You interviewed him. What sort of – I mean, did he – when confronted with his handiwork, did he show any humanity? Were you able to find any humanity in a person like him?
Well, I spent 2 hours with him, and they – you know, it's amazing how people in those positions can rationalize what they do as a kind of good. You know, even he conceded that the sort of emergency funds that had gone into the city had not reached the poorest of the city, and yet he has you know, built this massive medical complex, which is almost a city within a city. It has its own private security force of 65 security personnel, and there are cameras all around it, and it's like a gated community. I mean, the same Campbell Soup still has a kind of international office there, although they don't make anything there. They don't make soup there. And again, you know, a special bus picks people up at the train station, drives them through the gates into the corporate headquarters, and the corporate employees don't leave until it's the end of work. I mean, they don't even walk out those gates to get something to eat. Not that there is much to eat. I mean, Camden, like all of these poor areas that we went to, is just a food desert. There's no supermarket in Camden. There's one on the far edge of the city, but there's not one in the city. You have a choice of eating Crown fried chicken or donuts, basically. And that was true in West Virginia. I mean, you get to southern West Virginia, people have to drive over an hour. And then even when they get there, they can't afford fruits and vegetables because they're trucked in from California or Florida, and they're too expensive. So, you know, it's hard to know how much of it they believe. One of the interesting things about Norcross is that he was investigated for political corruption. There was a wire put on an informant. There were, you know, many hundreds of hours of tape. We only got 90 minutes that actually ever made it out into the public, but it's a brutal 90 minutes, which I include in the book because I think it's a good illustration of how power works when, you know, you get behind the smokescreen of public relations. How much of it does he believe? I don't know. But I came away with a sense that he believes some of it. I think it's very hard for those who commit evil on that scale to have a kind of personal reckoning with what it is they're actually doing.
I'm speaking with Chris Hedges about his brand new book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. This is Uprising, and Chris is going to be speaking tonight at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, 3300 Wilshire Boulevard at 7 p.m. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. Tickets will be available at the door itself if you haven't already gotten them through KPFK's website or during our fund drive. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll discuss Welch, West Virginia, as well as Immokalee, Florida, and the burgeoning movement of Occupy Wall Street. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Cheryl Lee Ralph, inviting KPFK listeners to come out to the Leimert Park Village Book Fair, Saturday, June 30th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Pulitzer Prize winner Isabel Wilkerson, activist Amiri Baraka, and poet Sonia Sanchez, just a few of the authors on the main stage. All-day readings and interactive entertainment. You won't want to miss the conversations about my new book, Redefining Diva, Life Lessons from the Original Dream Girl. That would be me, Cheryl Lee Ralph. There'll also be a tribute to the unforgettable Whitney Houston and late poet Gwendolyn Brooks. There's something for the entire family at the Leimert Park Village Book Fair on Saturday, June 30th.
Details at the KPFK website, kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor of the 6th annual Leimert Park Village Book Fair.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. With me still is Chris Hedges. We're talking about his new book that he's just written with Joe Sacco, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Well, your third chapter, Days of Devastation, focuses on Welch, West Virginia, state that is the heart of the coal mining industry in the United States. And I'm guessing that by using the term Days of Devastation, you're referring to the environmental devastation that also, of course, wreaks havoc on human health in West Virginia directly as a result of the coal industry.
Yes. I mean, although everything's gone in West Virginia, communities are gone. I mean, the mountains themselves, over 500 peaks, hundreds of thousands of acres are gone, never coming back. These gigantic impoundment ponds filled with heavy metals and toxic sludge, which occasionally burst. When they do, of course, they take a tremendous loss of life. I mean, it can just essentially wash away entire communities. We would go into small villages where everyone had their gallbladder removed because the water is so fetid. You go into elementary schools, and in the nurse's office, there are just rows of little inhalers. Because the air is poisoned, cancer is an epidemic. And it's when we flew over the Appalachians, which is really a terrifying experience because you can't get a sense of the scale of the destruction unless you're in the air. I mean, here are the headwaters for much of the eastern seaboard. Here are the lungs of the eastern seaboard being systematically destroyed for short-term profit because coal companies don't want to dig down for the coal anymore. Which, of course, is a very problematic energy source as it is. So they are blowing the top 400 feet off of the mountains and using some of the largest equipment on Earth to scoop it out. Drag lines are 25 stories tall, these huge bulldozers, where they just plow all the topsoil and the trees over the sides of these sort of denuded, plateaued mountains and then burn them. So when you're flying over, there's these massive fires. It's just insane. They leave behind a moonscape of, gigantic dams filled with toxic sludge and, mountains that will never be reclaimed, where nothing will ever grow. 2,000 streams poisoned, buried under this debris. And there's no way to stop it. They own the judicial officials. They own the elected officials. They own the press. I mean, they even write the school textbooks. I mean, Big Coal vets the books in school so that Nothing critical about big coal is even taught to the kids. And the consequences of it are, are devastating. And, of course, that assault against the ecosystem, our whole relationship to the ecosystem, is determined by large corporations like coal companies or ExxonMobil or BP or everyone else. Karl Marx was right. Unfettered, unregulated capitalism is a revolutionary force that has built within it a quality that leads to its own self-annihilation because it knows no limits. It has no capacity for conservation. And West Virginia is a truly terrifying window into our future.
Your fourth chapter, Days of Slavery, focuses on Immokalee, Florida. And this is a part of the country that is home to many, many undocumented immigrants who essentially help feed the nation. And we rarely hear much about Immokalee, although I should say our listeners here at KPFK have often heard about the coalition of Immokalee workers who have represented some of the most incredibly successful fights for decent wages or, you know, better than subsistence wages from these distributors that supply big companies like McDonald's and Burger King. But what exactly do you see Immokalee, Florida, as representing in terms of corporate devastation?
Well, it's where we're all headed. We begin the chapter with a quote from Bernie Sanders that says, in essence, you know, in the vast race to the bottom that's become America, Immokalee is the bottom. And here you have a working class utterly stripped of any bargaining power, any rights, any benefits. When they don't have work, they're not paid, so they will literally often be sleeping out on the ground. You constantly find examples of slavery where workers are held against their will, often behind barbed wire. They are told that if they report these abuses, their families in Mexico or Honduras or Guatemala will be harmed. Slavery isn't a new condition in Florida. You go back and look at Reconstruction or Jim Crow and the use of convict leasing in many ways for African Americans. It was worse than slavery. Certainly their survival rate was worse because when a convict died, you could go out and get a new one. You didn't have to buy a human being to work for you. Very few of the people in the convict leasing programs, and they would round up African Americans, charge them with vagrancy at harvest time, chain them, and send them out to the fields or the turpentine camps. Very few of them even finished their sentences. I mean, we don't know the death rate, but it was staggeringly high. That coupled with, of course, the reign of terror of lynching kept African Americans in check. So slavery is nothing new. It's just that institution of slavery has been perpetuated in places like Immokalee, Florida, in all but the name. And it's a look at where they want us to end up. In many ways, the Immokalee workers are sort of the perfect workforce in a globalized corporate economy because they're completely disposable human beings. And working in the fields is one of the most actually dangerous because of a lot of the pesticides and chemicals that are used in Immokalee are quite toxic. As you get older, you spend 8-10 hours a day bent over carrying 33-pound buckets of tomatoes. It wreaks havoc with your back. And workers line up in parking lots at about 4 in the morning to be selected by crew leaders, and Joe and I were in those parking lots, and put on the buses, and the older the workers get, the less they get selected. And by the time they're in their 30s, they don't get selected at all. And so they return back to Mexico or Guatemala as impoverished as when they came, physically broken. And one of the reasons that we can't get any statistics in terms of pesticide poisoning, which is thought by many people who have investigated this to have created huge problems with cancer within those who work in the produce fields is because these people are not traceable because they've left the country. And that's precisely where they want us. That's where they're pushing us. That's where we're going to end up. Immokalee is a kind of warning cry that if we don't stand up and resist, you know, we are going to be as stripped of power and of the capacity to make a living wage as, you know, as the working class and as the underclass.
Chris, in your book, you also several times refer to the sexual oppression that women workers face in your chapter on Immokalee as well as on Pine Ridge. Can you explain that to our listeners, what you and Joe saw in your travels through these sacrifice zones, as you call them, the added dimension of sacrifice, if you will, that women are subjected to?
Yeah, women are oppressed sexually, of course, but in much the same manner as workers. They're brought over, and oftentimes they don't have the money. Now costs about $2,000 to get across the border into the United States, and that's essentially becomes a debt that they're told that they can repay. At the height of the harvesting season, there's always a few trailers. I mean, that's another thing, that the only place to find residents are in these dilapidated, rat-infested, cockroach-infested trailers in trailer parks owned primarily by three white families in the town of Immokalee, where workers have to pay $50 in cash every week to have a mattress on the floor with 19 other workers. So these landlords are making $2,000 a month. In conditions that anywhere else in the country would be condemned. And they always set up, somebody sets up a few trailers at the height of the season, and they bring in women. They set up, put mattresses on the floor and then divide them by plastic sheeting or blankets, give them a tube of lubricating cream and condoms, and people will come in and they get a ticket and they get like 15 minutes. And these women can never escape. I mean, if they get pregnant, then they have to get an abortion, and that abortion is added to their bill. I mean, they are completely trapped in a system of debt peonage that replicates the debt peonage of crew leaders often impose on their workers so they can never escape. It's a kind of parallel form of oppression, but it's sexual oppression. And this is really what happens when you live in a world where that is starkly divided between the all-powerful and the all-powerless.
In the chapter on Immokalee, you profile a woman named Anna, and Joe depicts her story visually. And she says, people, when they think of America, they think they'll have a good salary. They think you live well. The reality is we're not free. We're treated badly. We have no voice and we're badly paid. Americans don't look at us as human beings. They look at us as tools for work, like a tractor or a machine. Chris, when you were saying that Immokalee is where we're all headed, do you get the sense that many Americans, even those who might be struggling, working class or lower middle class Americans, separate themselves from, for example, immigrant labor, thinking, well, that wouldn't happen to us?
Well, that's the problem. And that's the whole point of the book. The very forces, the very sort of corporate forces that carried out this assault on these parts of the country and on these the people who lived within these sacrifice zones now have complete control of both political and economic power. And the lesson is that they not only will but are beginning to carry out the same kinds of assaults against us that they carried out against those who we unfortunately turned our back upon. I think that, you know, America is being reconfigured in such a way that it's increasingly hard for most Americans to accept the myth or the fantasy of the quote-unquote American dream. The American dream has become an American nightmare. And, you know, I think one of the reasons that the state attempted to physically eradicate or erase the Occupy movements is that that was really a core message of Occupy. And it's a truth. It's a truth about power and how it works in this country. That those who have their hands on the lever of power do not want widely disseminated.
Well, let's talk about Occupy. Days of Revolt, the fifth and final chapter in your book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, is Liberty Square, New York City. When you and Joe started working on this book, the Occupy Wall Street movement hadn't happened. And, of course, very few people would have predicted that would have happened. And so you incorporated this into your book. But did you know beforehand? I mean, you did have the term Days of Revolt in your title, right?
Yeah. The book was always called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, because I think we both grasped that with no impediment left to corporate capitalism, eventually there would be some kind of a backlash. But we didn't know what it would look like. We didn't know when it would come. And then on September 17th, we saw this movement arise in Zuccotti Park. And it was sort of serendipitous that we wrote towards the end of the book that what had been conjecture now became real. And so we immediately knew that we had to end the book with the last chapter, Days of Revolt, because this is the beginning of the revolt, the understanding that the only mechanism we have left to protect ourselves from corporate capitalism, which of course is supranational. It has no loyalty to the nation state at all. It indeed is hollowing the country out from the inside. Are mass movements and finally civil disobedience that result in mass arrests. And so we were able, I think, to give a glimmer of hope despite everything that's been done to occupy by the security and surveillance state, that larger and larger segments of the population was waking up to the reality around them.
It's interesting to look at the people that you interviewed for this last chapter. One of the protesters who goes by the name of Ketchup says they want a riot. They can deal with a riot. They cannot deal with nonviolent protesters with cameras. But of course, in the end, most of the Occupy Wall Street encampments were very brutally and violently ousted, evicted by the police who, you know, if they didn't have a riot, created them. And how do you see the role that increasingly the security state is playing? It seems very much in the service of corporate elites.
Well, completely. And you know, that has been part of the whole effort to use the legal system to criminalize dissent. Rahm Emanuel gives us a little case study of that in Chicago. But Obama has been, the assault on civil liberties under Obama has been even more egregious than under George W. Bush. Not only has he not restored habeas corpus, but of course he supported the FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively makes legal what under our Constitution has traditionally been illegal, the warrantless wiretapping, monitoring, and eavesdropping of tens of millions of American citizens. And now we know that all of our personal records are being stored out in a supercomputer in Utah. As you know, I filed a lawsuit.
Right.
I was joined in that lawsuit by Noam Chomsky and Daniel Ellsberg and Alex O'Brien from U.S. Day of Rage and others over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which Obama signed into law on New Year's Eve when no one was looking. And this section empowers the U.S. military to pick up U.S. citizens who are deemed to be terrorists or to have relationships with this amorphous term, associated forces, hold them in military facilities, including our offshore penal colonies, and strip them of due process and keep them there until, in the language of that section, the end of hostilities, which, of course, is indefinite detention. Fortunately, when we challenged it in federal court, Judge Catherine Forrest issued a temporary injunction invalidating the law. We're waiting now to see whether the government will appeal. But all of this came under Obama. And I think that that's extremely important to remember, that the engine of the security and surveillance state is bipartisan. That the NDAA bill had bipartisan support, Carl Levin and John McCain, and was supported by the Obama White House. The only person who spoke up against the stripping of American citizens of due process was Dianne Feinstein, and they refused to write. She proposed putting an exemption for U.S. citizens in that section, and they refused to do it, both the Democratic Party and the Obama White House. So, it's where does power lie? And I think we are fooled by the political theater and the personal narratives of the candidates, which is really irrelevant. For me, the example with Supreme Court, dealing with this issue on Obamacare, Obamacare was written by the Heritage Foundation. It wasn't called Obamacare, but that corporate health care plan. It was adopted by then-Governor Romney in 2006. in Massachusetts, and then corporate lobbyists tweaked it to include $447 billion in subsidies to the pharmaceutical and insurance industry and got it passed under Obama. It's a kind of faux debate. It's basic. Obamacare is Romney care, and you can just, in piece after piece after piece of legislation, all of which is written and authored by corporate lobbyists, when you look closely and you sort of turn off the sound machine, you realize that, there's absolutely no check on the political control of corporate America. And that's why I think the Occupy movement is so important. And I think it's also why the Occupy movement frightened the power elite. I can assure you that there were no shortage of hedge fund managers and people at Goldman Sachs calling up Michael Bloomberg, especially when we were camped out in front of Goldman Sachs, where I was arrested with other Occupy protesters, saying, get the rabble off the street, get rid of them. And of course, that's what Bloomberg eventually did. Now, for me, that moment when they shut down those encampments was very telling, because a rational response to the suffering that has been visited on the poor and the working class and increasingly the middle class in this country, we now live in a country where roughly 20% of the workforce is either unemployed or underemployed, would have been a kind of New Deal solution, a way to create incremental or piecemeal reform that would mitigate this suffering. And that would include, of course, a forgiveness of student debt, a moratorium on bank foreclosures and bank repossessions, a huge jobs program, especially targeted at people under the age of 25, and a rational health care program, sort of Medicaid for all. And they didn't. They spoke exclusively in the language of force. And it's finally the ruling class that determines the configurations of resistance. And because they haven't responded rationally, and this is just a constant theme, by the way, of Paul Krugman's columns in the New York Times, it means that there will be another backlash. It is inevitable. Will it be called Occupy? Will it look like Occupy? I don't know. None of us know. I've covered movements around the world, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, the revolutions in Eastern Europe, the two Palestinian uprisings. And they, these movements have a kind of mysterious life force of their own. What triggers reaction is often something seemingly insignificant or banal. And the only thing you can know as a reporter is that it is coming. And I can assure you, having just spent the last 2 years among the poorest people in this country and having watched the utter inability of our corporate overlords to understand what is being visited on Americans. I mean, they've all retreated into their equivalent of the Forbidden City or Versailles. They've utterly lost touch. They're unplugged from the reality around them. And that is always an extremely dangerous situation. So the only thing I'm 100% certain about is that something will come. And we could go the wrong way. I mean, the 1930s, with right-wing populism, and we've got it. I mean, you've got the Tea Party, which is a proto-fascist movement funded by the most retrograde elements, the Koch brothers and others, within American society. It does what all fascist movements do in that it channels a legitimate rage and sense of betrayal towards the vulnerable, in this case towards Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals, intellectuals, liberals, feminists, and, of course, speaks in the language of violence and celebrates the gun culture. And I never take that lightly. I watched in war after war that I covered how you first get people to speak in the language of force before you get them to actually use force. And that's why, for me, the Occupy movement was so important, because it was a nonviolent movement, because it sought to protect the open society rather than shut it down, as, of course, the right-wing forces would attempt to do. But the longer political paralysis remains at the heart of our system, the more extremes are empowered, and the more vulnerable, the democratic state or what's left of it becomes.
Well, finally, Chris, do you see, however, growing connections, particularly because of people's ability to communicate so efficiently with one another, with movements like the one you've written about in Quebec, the student movement there, the student movement in Mexico, and the fact that Occupy Wall Street happened on the heels of what took place in Madison, the Arab Spring in many Arabic countries, the Chilean student movements. It seems as though It's not just Americans, of course, waking up and organizing, but so many different movements that are now learning about one another, not having to rely on the corporate media to inform each other of it. And by the way, congratulations on your LA Press Club Award for being named Best Online Journalist of the Year. And you, too, are part of this new media revolution. Do you see the new media being giving synergy to connections between movements around the world and that being a hopeful thing?
Of course. But the alternative media has always been the engine of change. If you go back to the 1960s, it was publications like Ramparts, headed by Bob Scheer, who, of course, runs Truthdig, the website I write for, that shamed the traditional press into doing their job. For instance, when Martin Luther King decides to speak out against the Vietnam War, he's in an airport with Ralph Abernathy, opens up Ramparts, he sees that iconic picture of the small girl running down the road naked after being napalmed. He pushes his food away. Abernathy said, "Is something wrong with your food?" And he said, "Nothing's going to taste right until I denounce this war," which he does in April of 1967. What is it that triggered a revulsion against the brutal police repression in New York? It was the pepper spraying of those three young women who had been kettled, seated on the sidewalk. Well, none of the traditional media photographed that. None of them were there. So any movement that relies on the traditional media is going to be, woefully displeased with the result, because especially with the consolidation of media, again, courtesy of Bill Clinton, with the deregulation of the FCC, we have powerful corporate forces, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Disney, Clear Channel, that control almost everything Americans see, watch, read, and hear. And these are forces that are deeply antagonistic to the Occupy movement, indeed to any movement. These alternative forms of communication, of course, technologically more advanced than they were a few decades ago, play the same role that the alternative press played, and that they are not constrained by the need to appeal to commercial interests. And, of course, the ability to communicate with movements. Let's remember, this is a global movement. What we're really dealing with is the breakdown of globalization, the collapse of globalization. And that's created a kind of worldwide synergy, which again we saw in 1968, although it may be on a vaster scale now. And I think that the elites, the corporate elites, are as corrupt, as discredited, and as out of touch with past dying regimes throughout history, whether that's the old Ottoman Empire, the old Austrian-Hungarian Empire, even the sort of last final days of the Roman Empire, where everybody went off to the arena. I think they're really that weak and that vulnerable, and that's always dangerous because they lose the will to power. And that's because people within those systems understand how decayed and rotten they are and won't fight for them. When Erich Honecker sent down an elite paratroop division, I was there in East Germany to fire on the demonstrators in Leipzig, they refused to do it. And after that, Honecker lasted another week in power. And I think that we have reached a similar kind of point in history where the foot soldiers of the elite, who are tasked with using forms of control, are weak and vulnerable and understand that they are not part of the 1%. I remember New York City cops earn $37 an hour as rent-a-cops in these big corporations, and they watch these guys in these $8,000 suits walk past them like they're a potted plant and part of the rest of the service staff, and get into their limousines and ride away. The object is to keep the movement nonviolent because we want to draw those forces, civil servants and others, over to our side, and that creates paralysis within the systems of power. And I've been, as you know, very critical of the Black Bloc. But we have to keep it a mainstream movement. The only weapon we have is our transparency, and a kind of final irony, our powerlessness. That is our greatest strength. And if we can begin to build the numbers that we've seen in Montreal, or the kind of numbers that I saw in Eastern Europe, then I think we can perhaps begin to affect significant change within our corporate state.
Chris Hedges, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I'm looking forward to seeing you tonight in Los Angeles at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Chris Hedges is the acclaimed author and veteran foreign correspondent. His book that we've just been discussing is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. He's co-written it with Joe Sacco, and he's going to be speaking tonight at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, 3300 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. The event starts at 7 p.m. Doors will open at 5:30 p.m. If you got tickets by purchasing them online through kpfk.org, or if you got them through our fund drive, then your names will be at will call. If you haven't purchased tickets but would still like to come, tickets will be available for purchase for $15 each at the door. Again, that is 3300 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. It's the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. I'll be emceeing the event, so I really look forward to seeing all of you there. Robert Shear of TruthDig.com will also be there, and Blaise Bompain will be speaking as well. Chris Hedges will be signing copies of his book, and limited numbers of his book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, will be available for purchase and signing. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Chris Hedges said in his book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, we may feel powerless in the face of the ruthless corporate destruction of our nation, our culture, and our ecosystem, but we are not. We have a power, as the Occupy encampments demonstrated, that terrifies the corporate state. Any act of rebellion, no matter how few people show up or how heavily it is censored, chips away at corporate power. Any act of rebellion keeps alive the embers for larger movements that follow us. That's Chris Hedges. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. By the way, breaking news this morning is that the Supreme Court has indeed upheld President Obama's signature legislation, the Affordable Care Act. The court interpreted the individual mandate of the law as a tax and upheld it 5-4. The decision is being hailed as a victory for President Obama. We'll cover the decision and its details and consequences on tomorrow's program. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews, rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook and Twitter, and find links and events we mention on the air. Send your story ideas to mail at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.